Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Hope you're all having a great week wherever you are. Obviously, happy Thanksgiving. Hope you all have a great Thanksgiving. But before the holiday, we have another episode of the show, and we're happy to be back as always. As always, you can check us out on Twitter at The Sit Down 7. Check us out on YouTube as well. I do a lot of great content on YouTube. We got a big show today. Obviously, we had a very interesting episode last week talking about, according to the government, the alleged boss of the Genovese crime family, Barney Bellomo. But today we're going to talk about a guy that was involved with the same family, but many years earlier. We're going to get into Frank Costello. We're going to talk about Frank's real rise from a little village in Italy all the way to America, coming up with the likes of Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano, and eventually becoming one of the most politically affiliated mobsters of all time. These connections that he had into the depths of not only in Hollywood, but in government, and really just the success that he had. We'll go through an interesting hearing he had in the Clefauver hearings and more along the way. And today we've got a great guest. We don't do a ton of guests on the show. Usually just me and Blackjack. But today I wanted to bring on my good friend, RJ Roger. RJ is a terrific author. He's a mob historian. And I got to tell you, I know he loves talking about Frank Costello. You can find a absolutely terrific YouTube channel that he has called Black Handprint Mafia. And you can also, which I highly recommend, go out and buy his book, The Olive Branch, 36 Rules of the Bosses. He's actually working on his fourth book that'll really be a better version of probably all of them. We'll get his thoughts on that. He's a longtime Cosa Nostra historian and someone I can now call a friend. RJ, good to have you on the sit down. I'm excited to talk about Frank Costello. How are you tonight, bro?
Oh, I'm fantastic, man. Thank you so much for inviting me. You know, this is my first time ever on a mob podcast.
So, it's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I've done some YouTube stuff, but never did anything like this before. So, yeah, it's great, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I urge all of our listeners, you know, go check out his YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe. He's done some really terrific videos. And what I like about RJ is he gets really into the kind of the overall, you know, past really just like the things that you already know. He gets into really the aspect of thinking about the mob in a different way probably than you've thought about it before. And what's cool about him is he's done some great episodes on, you know, kind of the older guys like, you know, Frank Costello or Joe Bonanno. But he's also done some great videos on, you know, Jackie D'Amico and Barney Bellomo and Jimmy Hoffa and all this different type of stuff. So I urge you, go check that out. I know he's got a lot of great things coming up. He's going to be one of the mainstays here with the mob genre. So as always, you know, happy holidays. We're glad to have you here on the show. As I've said time and time again, we will not have a show the week of December 10th, but that's the only time we're going to take off. We'll have plenty of shows up until the holidays and then into 2022 as well. So no Q&A today, no bullshit. Let's get right into the biography. Frank Costello on the sit down. And, you know, RJ, in kind of the beginning here, I think a great word to describe Frank Costello would be, and we brought this word up when we talked about Neil Delacroce. I always looked at Frank Costello as more of a pragmatist, a guy that, you know, really in his early years was definitely rooted in, you know, doing what he had to do to survive. You know, obviously he hurt people, but you know, really after his early 20s, he never really messed with the gun again. He was always someone that, you know, was very guided by kind of the real world. And he had these old school values, but he believed in connections. He believed in politics and having important people around you. What would be a word that you would describe Frank Costello? Is pragmatist a good one?
Yeah, that's about what I would say. I'd say that's probably the best. Yeah. You know, his thing with Frank was, you know, he used his strongest weapon was his mind. He understood the power of making connections, making friends, and not just friends that were, you know, able to just use muscle and power. I mean, like in the sense of a gun, but had real power as in the sense of influence, mm-hmm. able to affect industries and political politics and stuff like that. So, Yeah, that's what I would say. He's a pragmatist. He was a intellectual. He was a, you know, a forward thinker, a guy who saw the big picture.
Yeah, 100%. Well, let's get into his life. It's definitely a fascinating one, and it is one that began many years ago. Frank Costello on the sit-down. Francesco Castiglia was born January 26, 1891, and Costello was from a small village called Loropoli, which is in Cosenza, which is in Calabria. You know, Loropoli is a very small little village. I think to this day, it only has about 5,500 people. It's a beautiful, picturesque little place. And, you know, like many, the Castiglias or the Costellos down the road were looking for a better life. Frank's father would actually head over to the United States, his father, Luigi. And just a couple of years into Frank's life in 1895, his mother would decide that she was going to indeed make the trek across the Atlantic to join her husband in the United States. Maria Costello would take not only Frank, but his brothers, and they would head to New York. They would settle in Harlem, which we actually talked about this on the Tony Salerno show. Harlem back in the 1900s, 1910s, 1920s, was one of the biggest Italian enclaves in America. And for many years, they actually had a Little Italy. It was the Little Italy before Little Italy. You know, obviously today it's much more, you know, mixed. But back then it was the Italian spot. It was where all the Italians lived. They called it Italian Harlem in those times. Really everywhere between, you know, 116th, 125th, Lexington, Madison Avenue, everywhere. Southern Italians and Sicilians settled there. And that was really where the Black Hand was really first kind of in motion. So, you know, he would come over with his family. He was just a little child at that point. And upon settling, Frank's father actually would work in construction. There was also talk that at one point he was a grocer. His mother would work in a clothing shop. And by 13, Frank's brother was the first person to really get him involved in a life of not crime, but he kind of introed him to, you know, petty theft and things of that nature. He would begin a career with a gang called the 104th Street Gang, where he would go by the name Frankie. Now, another connection he had to the streets where he really kind of started connecting with undesirables was a woman that he knew called Pasquarella Spinelli. Miss Spinelli was a woman that owned a horse stable, and she would actually was moving stolen horses back in those days. And there was actually a mob lore that in that stable, it was actually a mob breeding ground. It was where gangsters would take bodies and she would bury them under the horse stalls, which that was this kind of first real connection. She wasn't necessarily a boss or anything, but she was definitely steeped in some criminal elements. So RJ, early in Frank's life, he was really kind of connected to the streets as any kid in those times was. Many kids in New York, it was hard to see a mother and father struggle. You see some guys in the street or even women in this stage that, you know, were doing well for themselves. And you could understand a family, the parents always working. You could see where a young child would see crime and want to get involved as well.
Yeah, you know, he often, you know, he didn't, a lot of those care staff, when they first came over, a lot of them had no choice but to go out and try to work. And, you know, and the mother and father didn't come here with that in their mind. When they left and came over to the U.S., they had, you know, this belief that this was the land of opportunity. This was the place where they could have a better life for their kids. But, you know, when they got here, they kind of saw that, man, it's tough here, too. It was very tough for the Sicilians, the Italians, to kind of find their place here. So it kind of put pressure on those young kids to have to help and go contribute. So a lot of these kids got out on the street, started doing petty crimes and stuff like that. I think Costello only has like a third grade education, or, you know, he don't have much, you know, formal schooling. And I can certainly tell you most of what I read. Those parents didn't come here with envisioning their kids following the same footsteps as they were for the opportunities that were left for them over in, you know, the country that they just came from.
No, the goal was to come and give not only you and your wife or husband a better life, but give your family one. And, you know, by the time you get here, you realize it's maybe not as great as you thought it would be, but it's, you know, a freer area and you can go and work, but you got to spend a lot of time at your job and your kids. Life starts to pass them by. By 1908, Frank is 17 years old and he gets arrested for the first time. He didn't have much schooling, as you said, but, you know, kids like this, they learn in the streets. By 1908, Frank would be arrested for assault and robbery, and he'd actually be arrested in 1908, 1912, and 1917. So, you know, he was definitely learning on the streets, but he was dealing with a lot of time he would plead out or would never go to court. He was just a kid at that point. But in 1915, he would actually get his first prison stay. In 1915, Frank would be arrested for having an illegal gun. He would do 10 months of a 12-month sentence. And that was his first real brush with having to go inside. It was in 1918 that something would change in his personal life, and he would remain with the same woman his entire life. In 1918, he would meet a Jewish girl called Loretta Geigerman, who was the sister of a friend of his. And again, she would be his wife really until the end. And we'll talk a little bit about their lifestyle a little bit down the road. By Frank's early 20s, obviously one of the main thoroughfares in the Harlem area was the part of the Morello crime family. And in Harlem, an individual called Ciro Terranova was a capo in East Harlem. And Frank would actually work under him in his early years. But by the early 20s, as we've talked about time and time again on this show, the Volstead Act is put in place and liquor becomes illegal. And this would kind of create our modern day mob. And we all know what happens and we'll get to that. But this is kind of where Frank Costello starts making connections, making inroads. This is where he meets Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky. And all these young whippersnappers are really the young guard of the new age gangster. And, you know, obviously they get connected with Arnold Rothstein. They start moving around with Big Bill Dwyer, who was a big time rum runner, Oney Madden, Dutch Schultz. And they create bootlegging networks that really have Arnold Rothstein at the height of them. But Rothstein was teaching kids like Frank Costello how to make business deals, make connections. You would agree, RJ, that, you know, not obviously not Italian, but Arnold Rothstein was really, I think, the brains into creating the people like Lucky Luciano. And I don't think we, and Frank Costello, we don't give Rothstein enough credit. He was really the brains of the mob way before, you know, your modern day Gambinos. And this guy wasn't even Italian.
No, he was the guy that really started a lot of what they became. I mean, Rothstein died when he was really young. He got killed. He got killed early on before, you know, the underworld really got overly got very organized. But he was there early. He was a lot of those guys' early mentors, and he was more than even just, I mean, he taught them everything, not just how to, you know, turn a racket, but he taught them how to dress. He taught them, like, you know, about fashion. He taught them how to do business and things like that. I mean, he really was a lot of those younger guys. He was their early mentor. He was the brains behind a lot of things, major financial backer. And, you know, what gave Rothstein a little bit of an upper hand is he comes from really good stock. You know, his father was a legitimate businessman, you know, was well-respected. He didn't come out of a gangland background. So Rothstein, when he was on the streets, you know, he was kind of like a thrill seeker to a certain extent. He was the only one of all those kids that kind of just went into the streets and stuff. But he brought that upper world understanding. And that's what he was, you know, impregnating into Meyer Lansky and Costello and Luciano and all of them was that. So you got that street knowledge, which is important, but also understanding politicians and businessmen and the legitimate world. And that's what Rothstein was able to help teach them.
Yeah, and he definitely did a great job. I mean, Arnold Rothstein was a very rich man, and you know, he turned a lot of these young kids from the streets into rich men as well. One of the interesting parts of Lucky Luciano's relationship with Frank Costello was the fact that one thing about Lucky that you could always respect was he was always going to work with people, regardless of whether they were Sicilian or whatever. He was always very much someone that was willing to work. And, you know, the old school guys, the guys like Morello and some of these old cats, would tell Luciano, look, you know, you shouldn't work with this guy. He's not Sicilian. That's how close and that's how the ties were bonded. In those days, if you were anything other than Sicilian, you were not respected. You didn't have to be just Italian. They were just saying, if you were not Sicilian, we were skeptical and not willing to work with you. Interestingly enough, they would call Frank Costello, quote, the dirty Calabrian. So Luciano would kind of, you know, go against some of the old world thinking. And that's one thing that made Lucky the legend that he was. He was willing to work with Jews. He was willing to work with non-Sicilians. And that would really make him, you know, kind of the influenced guy that he would become. Frank was obviously running and bootlegging, but he was also running and gambling and extortion. And as we talked about with Meyer Lansky, one of Frank Costello's main rackets throughout the years was gambling. And that's something we'll surely get into. In 1925, Frank Costello had become a citizen of the United States. So he'd finally get his papers. He was an American. He would be arrested in 1926. However, the charges would be dropped. And the charges would stem from bootlegging. When him and an individual called Big Bill Dwyer would be arrested, they would be accused of bribing two U.S. Coast Guardsmen, basically to kind of tip them off to some loads and things of that nature. And at one point, one of the boats would carry 20,000 cases of liquor. Luckily for Frank Costello, though, in 1927, the jury would be deadlocked and Frank would kind of skate out. Dwyer, though, would be convicted. He would get 2 years for bribing a Coast Guard official. And, you know, down the road, this would create some problems with other gangsters, including Dutch, Schultz, and others. As we know, as the Roaring Twenties come to an end, we see the Depression happen, RJ, and eventually the Castamillaris War ensues. We all know, we're not going to go into the depths of the Masseria Maranzano stuff. We talked about that during Lansky and Luciano. But again, just a quick thought. Lucky Luciano decides to play both sides of the fence, ends up killing Joe Masseria, and then kind of clouds the judgment of his other boss, the new boss, Salvatore Maranzano. He then kills him as well. And Lucky Luciano takes over the entire fucking thing and becomes the boss of all bosses. He creates the commission. Now, there was a huge role for Frank Costello in that new triumvirate. And, you know, again, RJ, this is what was so great about Frank Costello, these long-standing connections, the trust, the loyalty he built. I mean, for years, Lucky told them, don't deal with Frank. He's not a Sicilian. But I loved the one thing about Lucky that I would always talk about. He was always loyal. And when he became boss, he brought Frank Costello with him as consigliere.
Yeah. You know, Vito Genovese, I kind of got a, you know, a lot of those. The people who were like Lucky that were able to see in a broader way, that to just see value, what's like, what's your contribution to this Borgata or syndicate or Cosa Nostra, whatever you know, what's your contribution? What value do you have? And that's what, that was the brilliance of Lucky, that, you know, and, you know, Vito Genovese was a guy who was able to just, he was a killer, and he could kill on command, and he was ruthless, and he was just a, you know, just a hard knock. But what Costello had was the ability to make relationships, to court relationships in high places, and who had the ability to make friends with people who were not gangsters, you know, regular upper world figures like Costello. And Lucky saw that very early on. He talked about that. Even in his autobiography, he talked about that. And that's why he befriended Frank and brought Frank along. He knew Frank can take the, can Frank can take us forward. And that's really the, some of that early power with Tammany Hall. I'm sure you'll get into some of that, but a lot of that power, you know, came from Frank and the relationships that Frank was able to build with people who weren't a part of the Sicilian Cosa Nostra.
Yeah, and that's one thing that obviously, you know, Frank and I think Lucky were known for, is once Lucky kind of instituted the commission, and Tammany Hall had been under the auspice of the modern day mob really forever. I mean, back before Lucky even took over. And, Tammany Hall was the political triumvirate that ran the Democratic Party in New York City, and the mob had control of it. Politicians were taking from the city. They were taxing vice, and they were making themselves very rich in the process. And look, they were also making the citizens happy. They were doing things on behalf of the citizens. And there was a ton of money out of it. By the 1930s, it was pretty much controlled by Lucky Luciano. And Frank was integral in the control of Tammany Hall. The problem that Frank first starts dealing with is in politics. And we obviously know these crusaders that have tried to bid against the mob. Obviously, people like Robert Kennedy. We talked about Thomas Dewey with Lucky Luciano. But one of Frank Costello's big problems was Fiorello LaGuardia, who would become the mayor of New York City on January 1st, 1934, and become the 99th mayor of New York City. And he would actually start to come down pretty hard on the mob. In fact, he came down really hard on gambling. Basically, by this point, Frank Costello was very involved in gambling. He was a huge earner. And he controlled bookmaking. He controlled pretty much everything when it comes to gambling. And one of the big rackets was slot machines. They would be really in any bar, restaurant, cafe, drugstore, gas station. At one point, it was said that Frank Costello controlled over 25,000 machines, which is a huge amount of money. Think if just every machine earns a certain amount of money per week times 52 weeks a year. It is a huge amount of money. Now, one of the crusades that LaGuardia goes on with is he wants to rid New York of these illegal slot machines. He would confiscate in 1934 thousands of the machines and load them onto a barge and dump them into the Long Island Sound. He would basically crack them open, crack them apart, and throw them in the Sound, which I got to be honest, that doesn't sound very good for the Long Island Sound. Seems like a wild way to just throw stuff into the river. That's kind of wild. but Costello was always thinking, and he was a mover. His next thought was, you know what? I know through Meyer Lansky and obviously some of his gambling, Louisiana is a little bit more open when it comes to gambling. He would go to the governor of Louisiana, a guy called Huey Long, and he would say to him, look, how about this? You let me house my machines in your neck of the woods. I'll give you 10% of this massive take. And he would put one of his people in control of that, and they would make tons of money. And the individual, an individual called Costell, he would be the guy that would really run that. And he would be connected with Carlos Marcello. This would bring in tons of money to not only the Luciano crime family, but the state of Louisiana. So he would basically say, you know what, New York, you don't want my fucking money. You don't want to do business with me. I'll take my legalized gambling in my eyes and I'll take it to Louisiana and they'll benefit off of it.
Yeah, it's and that's really what even helped him, branch out and become even more powerful, where he could network across state lines, make relationships with other mob leaders around the country. So it didn't hurt him at all. It just made him more powerful. I didn't see how that hurt him at all. The worst thing that it did is it probably made him more public in New York, because it was kind of a big headline.
Yeah, it ended up probably helping him in a way because he left New York City, a place that was obviously not ever willing to do business. He could go down and really have a license to steal with these machines and really just put them everywhere. And this is something that made Meyer Lansky and him obviously gambling czars, really. I mean, Meyer basically thought of, you know what, I'm going to go to these really random locations, places like Saratoga, New York, and Hallandale Beach, Florida, where they like gambling. They're willing to play ball with me. I can have what I want. They can have what they want and everybody's happy. And that's something that Frank Costello was obviously huge with as well. Obviously I mentioned Frank had married his wife, Loretta, in 1918, and he would stay with her his entire life. They would actually settle in a beautiful apartment in the very swanky 115 Central Park West, which is right in Manhattan. Interestingly enough, it was a beautiful home. It was apartment 18F. He would rent it for $3,900 a month. And weirdly enough, the property was actually sold pretty recently for $5.3 million today. It was a beautiful apartment, 9 rooms, 2 bedrooms, 2 baths, perfect for a husband and wife. And, you know, Frank was starting to become a real mover and shaker, especially during this time, because as we know, in 1936, Lucky Luciano is convicted of running a prostitution ring with little Davy Battillo, and he gets a long prison sentence. At this point, it's kind of impossible for Luciano to totally run the family, and he instructs Vito Genovese to become the acting boss of the family. You know, Costello's right there as well. Problem for Genovese was he would be indicted on a murder charge from 1934 and flee to Italy. So it was now Frank Costello's family. And this is where all the money started to come in. He was already making money, but now the power would come. He would install his cousin, Willie Moretti, as the underboss of the family. And, you know, this is where everything starts to work out real well for Frank Costello. He begins kind of hanging out with famous people, Fred Astaire, Milton Berle, Walter Winchell, all these very uppity people in New York, a diamond merchant called Jacob Baumgold. He was hanging with magnates and rich people and powerful people. And weirdly enough, Bugsy Siegel actually lived just below Frank Costello at 115 Central Park West. So he was moving around. He was connecting with the right people. And some kind of interesting things, RJ, about Costello's personal life. It was said that Costello was a very early riser. It would be up by 7 a.m. generally. And he'd walk to the Waldorf Astoria barbershop in the hotel for a every morning. He would go there for a shine and a shave. He'd even get a manicure, have a nice lunch at the Madison Hotel. And on Thursdays, he would head over to the Biltmore Hotel, where he would, quote, get the works. He would have a sauna, a steam room session, and a great massage. So Frank lived a life, man. He was an uppity guy. He was a classy guy. It was also said that Frank Costello would see a psychoanalysis once a week, and he became a major donor to the Salvation Army. And he'd turn over the Copacabana nightclub that he had for holiday fundraisers. So Frank was an interesting guy. Why do you think he saw a psychoanalyst?
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons why he's actually probably one of my favorite bosses I've ever researched. Truth about Frank Costello is some people are just pure gangsters, and they get into that life. And they, like, you know, since you keep bringing them up, Vito Genovese, I mean, they were vastly different guys. Some guys are just, it doesn't matter how much money they make, doesn't matter how much power they ever take, you know, the excitement for them is being a gangster. It's being in that life, being in the thrill of being Cosa Nostra. But that really wasn't Frank Costello. Frank Costello, you know, had an objective when he got involved in that life. He wanted to, you know, make money and be respectable and gain power and influence and things like that. And he would have done it no matter what way he had to take it. It wasn't that he had this love, in my opinion, at least some great love or infatuation with being a mobster. I just think he wanted to have respectability, power, and influence. And, you know, so I think when he started to have those things, but it was still being connected to that mob life, you know, it's that pull between what you are, but what you want to be. And that's typically when we're going through that, we all end up, you know, going to see a therapist, going to see a psychologist.
Yeah, you got to do what you have to do. And when you're rich and you have the ability to better yourself, back in those days, you were going to go and you were going to go do it. So he was definitely an interesting guy, definitely was moving around. And, you know, the big thing about Frank Costello was, obviously, something that we talked about before, they would call him the prime minister of the underworld. And that was really the connection between him and just kind of trying to be good with everyone. I mean, he knew the cops, he knew judges, he knew politicians. Obviously, we've talked about it with Meyer Lansky. Listen, the Luciano crime family had, in a way, very damning evidence against J. Edgar Hoover. They had stuff that J. Edgar Hoover didn't want them to have. Look, back in those days, being homosexual, maybe being a crossdresser, was not something that J. Edgar Hoover wanted people to know. And I think the mob surely had compromising information. And people like Meyer Lansky and Frank Costello were the brains behind that. Now, again, it doesn't matter how you get blackmail. In the case of Frank Costello, he had it. And those connections were big. It was also said that in mob lore that J. Edgar Hoover was a, I don't know if you've ever heard this, was a big gambler. In fact, he was a big
time. Big gambler. Big
he was
time.
A big horse bettor, and he would owe money to Frank Costello, and he was always seemingly on the hook to Frank. And look, having sway over people is huge. And this is something that really Frank Costello was sure of. It was also something that would come out. There was all talk in 19, I believe it was 36, an individual called Thomas Aurelio becomes a prosecutor in New York City. And there was a wiretap that was put on Frank Costello's phone. And he would talk about a conversation between Aurelio and Costello, where Costello would call Aurelio. Aurelio would respond, "Good morning, Francesco. How are you? And thanks for everything." Costello would respond, "Congratulations. It went over perfect. When I tell you something is in the bag, you can rest assured." Aurelio would respond, "It was perfect. Right now, I want to assure you of my loyalty for all you have done. It is undying." Costello would respond, "I know. I'll see you soon." And this would subsequently mean that this was probably the fact that Costello was engaging in activities to basically nominate Aurelio for public office. And he had plenty of people indebted to him. Eventually, in 1943, Aurelio was elected to the position of Justice of the Supreme Court. These are the kind of people Frank was doing business with. He wasn't doing business with, you know, low-level associates on the street that could get him jammed up. He was dealing with the most powerful people. And I've always said this about Frank Costello, and I think you'll agree. When you look at Frank Costello, do you look at him? I guess he is a gangster per se, but he was probably the highest level of a gangster as far as he's a gangster by name, but he's not really a gangster.
No, I would completely agree. He was a, you know, I guess what we would say, kind of what we look at, maybe like a Paul Castellano, like what he kind of became or what he wanted to be. That's kind of how Frank was at a time. You know, Frank didn't want to be out in the street with guns. He wouldn't have wanted to be a drug dealer. He wouldn't have even, you know, respected those rackets. You know, Frank Costello was, you know, he was a gentleman and he was a, He understood business. He understood how to make money. You know, I would agree. I wouldn't call Frank Costello a gangster. I guess he was technically, and I'm sure his younger times when he was younger, he probably had to be a little tougher than he.
Would you agree though that he's kind of like he's the regal version of the mob, and he would be the closest thing we have. And had, like, he was the Arnold Rothstein of, like, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, right? You would agree with that.
He actually inherited a lot of his political connections. So yeah. A lot of Costello's political connections were because, you know, they were established and set up first by Arnold Rothstein. When Rothstein got killed, Costello just already knew those people because he built those relationships alongside Rothstein. But of a lot of the people who was around Lucky and things like that, Costello had the ability more than anyone else to, you know, he was a likable guy. People liked him. It's just, I mean, it was just something about him. And he had this, you know, this polish to him, but at the same time, he had this like, kind of like this, you know, this really raspy, rough voice and this kind of like a lord type of thing to him. And I mean, people found him interesting.
And this is what made, obviously, the modern-day Genovese crime family, Luciano crime family, this is why they're the most powerful group of people ever assembled in the mob. It's not even a question. The two most powerful people, arguably, in the history of the mob were Meyer Lansky and Frank Costello. And they were made in lieu of Lucky Luciano, who was probably the most powerful person. Now, eventually, they would become very powerful people as well. But these guys were the true Ivy League of the mob. They were regal people. They were people that made a ton of money. And what's one common theme between not only Lansky, but Costello? And this was one of Rothstein's downfalls. Rothstein was a compulsive gambler. Okay. He would ultimately be killed over a gambling debt. People like Lansky and Costello realized, I don't gamble. I let other people gamble and I take all the money that I make from those people because of their their issues. And one of the reasons he probably saw a psychoanalyst was so he didn't delve into that nonsense. Did he maybe have a scotch or some alcohol occasionally? Probably. Did he go out once in a while with his wife? Sure. But he would not indulge in some of these things like drugs and getting into selling drugs and carrying guns. He just didn't do stuff like that. He was the Ivy League, the regal aspect of the mob. Interestingly enough, obviously Lucky's in jail during all this time in the 40s. He obviously has his brushes with the American military and does his service there. But there was one issue that he would have, and that would be down the road, Vito Genovese. Vito would kind of be cleared of the stuff and he'd come back. And in 1946, obviously, as we know, Lucky Luciano would instruct the Havana conference to happen. They would all go down to Havana. And Vito would really start to take umbrage. He wanted to be the new kind of guy. He wanted to be the up and comer, the next great thing. And that would be something that Frank Costello would have to deal with. Interestingly enough, let me ask you a yes or no answer. You would agree. Frank Costello was a much better person to control his family over a psychopath lunatic like Vito Genovese. Vito Genovese was everything Frank Costello wasn't.
Yes, there's no question. Absolutely.
And, you know, this would really be a thorn in his side, in Lucky's side, everybody's side. Now, this was, you know, a longtime friend, but I almost always felt like Vito Genovese was that friend of yours that, you know, you love, you know, he's your guy, you've been with him forever, he's been with you forever, you love him, he's loyal and you're loyal, but you know deep down that he's probably going to do something that you don't want to be a part of at some point. And, you know, you try to keep him close, but not too close because you don't want him to rub off on you. Eventually, Genovese became completely out of control, and we'll get to that in a second. I always found kind of the interesting parts of the early 50s was the Kefauver hearings. Estes Kefauver, a senator from Tennessee, would really kind of start investigating the mob. In the 50s, there was all sorts of things that were going on. The war had passed, and I think really the federal government was frankly probably just maybe a little bored, and they started looking into the mob. They would start having a hearing called the Kefauver hearings, and Frank Costello would be asked to testify. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen these videos. They're quite funny. In 1951, he would go in front of the Kefauver hearings, and you know the Kefauver hearing would grill him on, you know, all sorts of different things, including, quote, "What have you done as a citizen?" they would ask him. He would respond, quote, "I paid my tax." And they would really just kind of try to get him to admit the things that maybe he didn't do. They would also ask him a difficult question involving $50,000 in a safe in his apartment. They asked him what that was about. He said, quote, "I believe I had a little strong box. I would keep $40,000 or $50,000 there." Now, ultimately, this would be a problem for him. He would be in trouble after he would refuse to answer any more questions. He would storm out and be slapped with contempt of court and get a 14-month prison sentence. However, it wasn't just that. The IRS would come after him as well. And they would try to jam him up on tax charges, claiming that Frank evaded for $73,000 between 1946 and 1949. He would eventually get 5 years, but he would appeal. So this is something that I always found interesting, this Kefauver hearing. They would really kind of grill Frank Costello. Have you ever seen that video about Frank just kind of not wanting to admit to anything and just trying to kind of get out of things?
Oh, yeah. I watched it. I read a lot of the transcripts. And, you know, that was the weakest I've ever saw, at least from a research point, ever saw Frank. I mean, it's the whole thing. He looked out of his element. I think he, you know, it kind of revealed a little bit of probably, you know, his inner weaknesses. You know, he was, I'm not sure if you remember the part about the hand dance, the hand ballet. He was so nervous. His hands were sweating. He was perspiring really bad. He looked uncomfortable. You know, he already has that raspy voice, but it was even, his voice was even more shaky. He just, you know, that was the one place that that he buckled. You know, he wasn't able to, you know, woo those people the way he typically had success with, you know, getting over on those very same politicians.
Yeah, he definitely, you know, look, I think he reacted just like a lot of other people would react. in front of, you know, tons of people. It's hard. You don't want to admit to anything. You don't want to say something that's going to get you jammed up. You know, good for Frank, though. He actually would appeal this conviction. And he would be fined $20,000. He would appeal the conviction in 1954 and was released on $50,000 bail. So he would go into prison, come out. He had kind of this stretch where he would go in and out. But in 1956, things kind of start to come undone for Frank Costello. And really, Vito Genovese fucked up a good thing because of his money-hungry, power-hungry obsession with being the boss of all bosses. And this would be ultimately Vito Genovese's downfall as well. But in 1956, an individual called Joe Adonis chose to be deported to Italy over a longer prison sentence. And this would be a problem for Costello because by this point, Joe Adonis is gone. Luciano is gone. He's starting to lose some of his kind of friends in the family. And Genovese also takes care of, and through Carlo Gambino, eventually Anastasia's murdered. So he's out of the way. He was a Costello ally. So in 1957, Genovese decides, you know what, fuck Frank. We're going to get rid of him. I want to take over this family. So as we know, what happens, Vito Genovese orders a very young Vincent Gigante to go and kill Frank Costello. Now, this hit is always interesting because you look back on it and you say to yourself, obviously Gigante down the road becomes the controller of the Genovese crime family and takes them to heights that, you know, they had achieved really during the likes of the Lucky Luciano years. But you go back and look at it, when it all comes down to it, he completely fucks this hit up, like, badly. And you have to ask yourself, how does he not get dealt with a little bit more than he was? So let's kind of talk about the hit. On May 2nd, 1957, Frank Costello is out to dinner with his wife and a few close friends. He had to take care of some business, so he would stay out for drinks and then catch a cab home to his apartment at 115 Central Park West. That night, the individual at the door was a guy called Norvell Keith. He's there. Frank pulls up to the building. It's a black Cadillac. It pulls in behind the taxi. And as Frank's walking into the lobby, a, quote, large male jumps out of the car and follows Frank into the lobby. He fires one single shot into Frank Costello's head. Frank would crumble into a leather couch, bleeding as the gunman raced out and ran into the streets of Manhattan. It was just a flesh wound, though. And I feel like Vincent Gigante made the bad mistake of not shooting multiple times. I don't know if he just got spooked or what. Costello's rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, where they confirmed that the bullet had only curved around his skull from his right ear to his neck and exited without causing serious damage. Total dumb luck. Frank would be released hours later and taken to the West 54th Street Police Station, where he would be questioned. In the typical Frank Costello, I'm from the streets, I've been around forever, he claimed that not only he didn't get a look at the man, but he did not even hear a shot. I'm sure if Frank could have, he would have just said, I don't know, I fell and this bullet just entered my head somehow. I don't know how it happened. The doorman would be a little bit more helpful. He was very much willing to talk. And he said that the individual was a stocky 6 foot tall guy. But by this point, Frank was in trouble with the police and with the FBI. He would also claim, quote, I don't have an enemy in this world. People were getting frustrated. They knew obviously this was an attempted mob hit, but this was a fascinating hit, just beyond the fact that it was funny because the pictures of Frank with the bandage around his head, he was just a lucky guy. Not only was he rich and powerful, but he was lucky.
Yeah. You know, all I can think when I look at this hit is that he must have thought he shot him in the head. Now, my understanding is that those hats that Frank used to wear,
yeah,
those bands around, like that, like those bands that he used to wear around the hat with these really, really thick bands was my understanding, where it would almost look like it went into your like your head almost. Like, so my understanding is I think the bullet went into that. And or I mean, who knows? I can tell you this. I don't know how you botch a hit that big, that sizable, and not finish the job, and then end up becoming the boss of that right. same family one day. That's incredibly strange. Even if they didn't kill him, typically you wouldn't be a guy who they would look at as someone worthy of any kind of serious responsibility.
Yeah, by this point, once Gigante takes care of this hit, or at least he thinks he takes care of the hit, he gets spooked and goes on the run. He goes up to upstate New York. He's like 300 pounds at this point, loses a ton of weight, goes on a diet, eventually turns himself in for the hit, and he goes on trial for attempted murder. Luckily, though, they kind of start leaning on the doorman. They kind of taint his credibility. And Frank Costello obviously says, I don't know who the fuck shot me. There's also a very famous point in court where you can hear Chin Gigante say, thanks, Frank. And it's kind of an ode to, no matter I fucking hate you, you fucking hate me, I'm still never going to turn you in for what you did. And this is a stone cold gangster move. You know, there's people in the streets that will begin, oh, that guy shot me, this guy shot me. Frank Costello didn't do that. Interestingly enough, during the hit, when he was treated for the wound, the police would search Frank Costello's clothing and they would find a handwritten memo. It was pretty interesting. It was, quote, not cryptic at all. Right on the little piece of paper, it would say, gross casino wins as of 426.57. $651,284. Casino win, last markers, $434,595. Slot win, $62,844. And there was money paid to, quote, Mike, Jake, L, and H. And that would be a connection to Frank's involvement and the Luciano family's involvement with the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas. Now, we're not going to go into all of that. That'll be for another show. But, you know, this guy just had interest everywhere. He had interest in you know, nightclubs, in gambling, in casinos. This guy was just incredible. That was always a very interesting, non-cryptic message. He just had that in his coat pocket.
Yeah. That's when that little piece of paper is what they used to indict him next. Because, you know, it proved that he had an interest in these things that he was kind of off the books for. So, and it also showed the vast profits. I think it was like, during that time period, you know, we talk about $700,000. Yeah. I mean, if adjusted for inflation, I mean, that is millions and millions of, and I think that was just a month's take, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that would have been the gross that I think the mob had made that far just from that casino. Keep in mind, $700,000 in 1960 is about, I don't know, that's $6.2 million.
It'd be something like that. It's in the, I mean.
And that's just off one casino. And this would obviously start to show that there was a very significant presence in Las Vegas. In fact, the Nevada Control Board actually traced two rogue employees, individuals called Louis Lederer and Michael Tonico, were two rogue employees. They promptly would leave the Tropicana and ultimately, combined with the casino's announcement intended to repay Castle's investment, there was really a connection between this Castell guy that was running the machines many years ago and Frank Costello out to Las Vegas. So that was kind of an interesting part of the attempted hit. Now, obviously, after this hit, Frank Costello, you know, kind of sees the writing on the wall, if you will. Eventually, Mr. Albert Anastasia would be killed. Apalachin would happen. And Frank Costello would retire in a way. He would kind of go on the shelf. And this kind of worked out well for Frank. He was a very rich man. He wasn't a gangster per se anyway. And he was still very much connected. He would evolve himself with people like Carlo Gambino, and he would even host meetings with Carlo and Tommy Lucchese. They would meet him at his Waldorf Astoria penthouse, and they would talk about different affairs. He would also keep close with Meyer Lansky. And Frank enjoyed fishing. He also enjoyed gardening and going to flower shows, which is what old men generally do, I feel like. Sadly, though, in 1961, the Supreme Court would uphold a lower court order that would strip Costello of his citizenship. But in 1964, the same court would set aside a deportation order for Costello, citing a legal technicality. So, you know, he would ultimately get to stay here, which was great, because obviously his old friend, Lucky Luciano, would talk tons about how he missed New York and America so much when he was never allowed to come back. And Luciano would go to restaurants in Naples just to hear New York people speak. That's how much he missed New York. So Frank would obviously be able to live here still. In early 1973, Frank Costello would have a heart attack in his Manhattan home, and we rushed to a hospital. He would die on February 18th, 1973. Now, keep in mind, Frank had been retired for about 12 years by this point, and he would live his life really in pretty much calm. He died in his own control, in his own bed, in a hospital bed, but he wasn't in prison. He would have a small memorial at a Manhattan funeral home, and it was attended by about 50 people, including friends and relatives. He would be buried in a private mausoleum at St. Michael Cemetery in East Elmhurst, Queens. Now, interestingly enough, Frank developed another enemy, and this would have been Vito Genovese's kind of protege, if you will, another complete psychopath. In my opinion, one of the biggest sociopaths in the history of the mob. Carmine Galante hated Frank Costello, and he would actually, upon being released from prison in 1974, bomb the doors of Costello's mausoleum. Really a disgusting act. Look, the guy's dead. Leave him be, for God's sake. How much do you have to hate a person, RJ, to try to destroy them even after they're dead?
You know, you couldn't have phrased it better when you said one of the most disgusting. I mean, this guy was a pure sociopath. I mean, I put people like him and Vito Genovese, there's a couple other ones. I would almost put Crazy Joe Gallo in there. Some of those guys that were just pure psychotic sociopaths. They were numb to any sort of, emotion or anything. They just saw the world in a way that was so different than, you know, a rational minded person. And, you know, and Frank Costello, I mean, talk about a classy example of everything, you know, we would want to be as, you know, was all that he went through. I mean, he came over to this country in a cooking pot, for Christ's sake, and rose to be this powerhouse that was, you know, working with, you know, presidents, FDR and the governor, Al Smith, and all these people. And, you know, classy guy who got out, walked away, kept his life, you know, and, you know, died free. That's a gangster's paradise. You know, why would you want to, you know, that should be the example, not the something that makes you angry.
No, well said. And interestingly enough, in 1972, just before Frank's death, he would die about a year later, the FBI would actually make one more attempt to try to make a run at Frank Costello. They would advise Frank just some things. And he would say that, quote, "I am now old and I have nothing to do with the rackets or racket connected guys." He would also claim that he spent the weekend at his home at Sandpoints, Long Island, and came into New York City just today. He would say on July 20th, 1972, that his usual routine would be staying in his New York City apartment at 115 Central Park West from Tuesday to Friday, and he would go out to Long Island on Friday and return again on Tuesday. He'd also state that he'd been in the jail for 11 years following his conviction on that tax case, and that he did not know any gangsters, including Tommy Ryan Aboli. He had, quote, "only known Tommy for a short time," and that Tommy was there once he got out and, quote, "grew like a mushroom." He met him on two occasions, both times in restaurants, and that was about 6 years before. He would also be asked if Tommy Ryan was the backup man when Chin Gigante shot him. Costello advised that Gigante was acquitted of that charge and that he had never heard that Tommy Ryan had anything to do with the shooting. He'd also said that he'd been away from people with a bad reputation for many years was asked if he had met with Carla Gambino in the Waldorf Astoria about 1 year before. Now, it was proven that he did, but he would admit that he had forgot about this, and he actually had just accidentally met Gambino randomly in the Waldorf Astoria and, quote, had never met him. So he decided, hey, maybe Carla want to have lunch with me, which he did. He'd also say that he did know Gambino from 35 years ago when they were both rum runners during Prohibition. So, you know, this is the great thing about these old school gangsters, man. They never upset the apple cart. They were always, I don't know who that is. I never heard of that guy. I always go back to the great hearing when Tony Accardo is being peppered with questions about, do you know Jackie Cerrone? Do you know Tony Spilotra? Do you know this person? Do you know that person? And he just kept saying, I don't know that guy. I don't know what he does for a living. I don't know anything. This is these old guys. They don't make guys like this. They haven't made guys like this for a very long time. And I did want to also mention one thing. There is thought, and I know Anthony DiStefano would talk about this. He had been interviewed a few years ago by Seth Ferrante, who is a writer for Vice at one point. And Ferrante asked him about Frank Costello. Many believe that the inspiration for Don Corleone in The Godfather was partly Frank Costello. DiStefano would say that he doesn't believe that Don Corleone was based on one person, but that there were possibly a couple people involved, including inspiration from not only Costello, but Joe Profaci and Carlo Gambino. But you would agree there was definitely an auspice, especially with the raspy voice, the Don Corleone. Now, I want to ask you, RJ, you did a great video on your YouTube channel. And again, I urge people to go check this video out. You did a video about Frank Costello, and you talked about a quote Frank Costello had that Cosa Nostra was started as a matter of survival. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so he was having lunch with, I don't know, a lot of people don't know about this, but Gianni Russo was a major errand. He ran a lot of errands for Costello. Yep. And one of the things, one of the really interesting stories I always loved that Gianni shared was that he was just having lunch at the Waldorf with Frank. And, you know, Frank Costello always carried this when he first came over here. And, you know, like we talked about earlier in the show, you know, there was tough times here. And, you know, Frank was in a poor family. His father didn't provide well. So he went down, Frank himself went down to the, you know, the docks to see about this job opening. It was all these dock workers and stuff. And he found the article in the New York Times that they were hiring these people. So when he gets there, he finds out that they're paying Italians less money than all the other people on the docks. So he said, you know, screw you. I'm out of here. I'm not going to work for less just because I'm Italian. And, but he carried that clipping, that New York Times clipping, he carried that in his wallet for the next 40 years. He never took that out of his wallet. And the reason he said he carried that was a reminder to himself that Cosa Nostra to him meant more than just making money and things like that and having power. It was an identity to their people and to take care of each other, and that, and it was about respect and personal development and growth for the Italian people, and that they had to look out for themselves, and why they had to create that organization because of situations just like that. So I always thought that was a great story. You know, when we talk about Cosa Nostra, so oftentimes we talk about all the bad stuff and the bloody history, but there's a lot of rich history and rich reasoning as to why that organization was started. I try to talk about some of that sometimes, because you go back to those times, it was really tough times over here in the early 1900s for, you know, for Italians. It was real, I mean, it was a rough area.
Yeah, Frank Costello, I think, and that's really a fascinating kind of look into kind of the creation of the modern day mob. And look, I've said this before and I'll say it again. This is kind of the end of our shows on this kind of trio. And we still got to do Vito Genovese, who's totally different. But this Luciano Lansky Costello grouping, really just one of the biggest and best parts of the mob. I mean, they really took the mob from gangs to a group and to a huge and very powerful organization that, you know, for large parts of the 40s and 50s and 60s were integral into the American landscape. And Frank Costello was the most politically connected mobster really ever. I mean, there were some great ones. I mean, even recently, Anthony Scotto passed away. He was a part of the Gambinos, kind of a very similar person to Frank Costello, very connected in politics. But they didn't make him like Frank Costello. He was a regal guy. He was powerful. He was rich. Didn't really do much or any prison time, you know, a couple years throughout his life. But you look at that time really in his late teens, he really didn't go to jail until, what was that, in the late 10s? He didn't go to jail again until the 60s. And that was for a very short period of time. So, you know, he died very rich. He died very powerful. I'm sure his family still has, you know, is doing well for themselves. This guy was a fascinating guy. This is that grouping of guys that really made the Genoveses what it was and made the American Mafia what it was. Frank Costello, RJ, just a fascinating individual.
And you know, like, and you talked about, you just said Meyer, Lucky, and Costello, but Genovese, even though he was so vastly different, he played a critical part. Those four as a group essentially covered all four corners. You know, Meyer understood rackets and business and supply and demand. He was a reader. He always carried books and he kept up on current events and what was going on in the world. So he was the one that was able to keep, you know, bringing information in and giving them ideas and stuff. He wasn't the kind of guy who could like build relationships as that well as like Costello. And that's the stuff that Costello did. He built all those relationships with those powerful people. Lucky was kind of the visionary, could see, you know, the future a lot better. He had the, like the grand ideas on how they can make, you know, this thing big and powerful, partnering with different types of people from different ethnic backgrounds and stuff like that. But what Genovese did, he was that muscle. He was the, and you need that. You can't just have all brains and smiles and heart. You got to have a guy who can be tough. And Genovese was behind a lot of those hits, a lot of that planning. You know, he planned to help with a lot of the strategic planning on the wars that they had to fight, the people that they had to take out. He shot Tom Rina to help swing power, you know, to the other side. And, you know, he was, I think, involved in the Mazaria hit. So, you know, he was involved in a lot of big hits. And, you know, but even though that might seem like the psychotic part, it was a crucial part to forwarding that foursome forward.
Would you agree they're surely the most powerful people in the history of the mob, that foursome group there?
It's unquestionable.
Exactly. I mean, when you look back on, and we'll kind of wrap it up, but we look at the power that the Genovese families had over the years. I mean, from that group, you know, even into the Salerno Giganti connection, the Benny Squint-Lombardi, just the sheer power and influence and money that was made over the years. You ever think about that, RJ, like from, let's just say the 1930 to 2000, how much money do you think the Genovese family made?
Oh my God, we couldn't even count it. Billions and billions of
hundreds
dollars.
Of billions.
Oh my God. It's innumerable. It's, you can't even add it up.
Crazy, I mean, to think about, isn't it?
It's unreal. It's unreal. That's, I mean, and this is the reason why I started my channel. It's why I write books on a more academic level, because I think that it's so intriguing, so fascinating that this stuff could be taught in major universities in an academic setting. That, you know, there's no question. Hey, real quick, I know you're getting ready to wrap up. I'm just curious because we didn't talk about it, but do you are you aware of how Costello got his name, that from Castiglia to Costello?
I don't. And that's actually a fascinating question. It is something that I wondered, you know.
You want to know? I can tell you.
Yeah, I do. I would just say that I guess it would probably just, I know he called himself Frank when he came over here, and that's a normal Francesco to Frank, but I'm guessing some sort of immigration thing. I don't know. Tell me.
No, so his name again, you know, is Francesco Castiglia. And so Lucky, it was Lucky, Meyer Lansky, Frank Costello, and Bugsy Siegel when they were a lot younger, get ready to go. And they would get ready to break into this like waterfront warehouse. And they were like breaking in warehouses and stuff like that all the time and doing little jobs. But every time they were getting ready to break into something or go on a job, Lansky and Bugsy were always the first ones through the door. So they had kind of like the heavy lifting. So they're getting ready to plan this, they're mapping out a plan to go into this waterfront warehouse. And Bugsy, again, is getting ready to go in with Meyer. And Meyer says, hey, why you guys always send the Jews in first? And he says, you know, there's two Italians here too, meaning Lucky and Costello. And in a joking way, Lucky Luciano says, what do you mean there's two Italians here? It's actually two Jews, one Mick and one WAP. And then Meyer Lansky says, what do you mean? Who's the who's Irish here? And in a joking way, Lucky says, him, Frank Costello. And Costello is a very prominent Irish name. He was just making a joke about Costello.
I never knew Costello. I mean, it sounds Italian to me. I never heard of it as a.
It was an Irish, and that name is actually so they just it was they were just having fun, just playing around, and so yeah, and that name just happened to stick. And Lucky talked about in his autobiography, he said like that name actually helped down the road with Costello being able to broker all those relationships with those politicians, because you know the Italians weren't looked at as being, you know, the academics or smart people and stuff like that. They were looked at like gangsters, but the Irish were like the policing force and the upper world guys and the businessmen. So that name, it made people think that Frank was Irish, but he wasn't.
A legend nonetheless. Really glad we're able to do this. Glad you're able to come on. I've always been fascinated by people like Frank Costello. Next week, I got a great show planned for you. We're really going to start to delve into some of my favorites. And it's not just Italian. It's not just drug dealers. We're going to get in next week to someone that I know a lot of you guys don't know a ton about. We're going to talk about one of the most epic gangsters in the history of New York, particularly in Chinatown. We're going to talk about Uncle Benny Ong, the godfather of Chinatown. This is a guy that came from the very poor rice fields of China, came over in his early teens and really became the most influential Asian gangster in the history of New York City. And when we talk about control and power in Chinatown, the Hip Song King was huge and he controlled that. We're going to talk about Benny Ong next week on the sit down and really kind of look into Asian crime and Chinatown in the 80s and then the 90s. RJ Roger, I urge all of you guys, every single person that listens to this, whether you follow me on YouTube or not, go check out Black Handprint Mafia, Black Handprint Mafia. RJ Roger is really coming up in the game, doing some great things, putting out some great videos. And I know you'll keep us updated, RJ, on some of the great books that you're going to write, some of the great content you're going to put out. We'll have to get you on again for a show real soon. Just kind of let us know where we can find you again and what do you got cooking?
All right. Well, yeah, I'm on YouTube as Black Handprint Mafia. My name's RJ Roger. I'm a writer. I have one book right now available anywhere books are sold called The Olive Branch, 36 Rules of the Bosses. It's being republished now. It'll be out next year as a book called The Don, 36 Rules of the Bosses. It's a republication with 7 new chapters. And I'm on Instagram at RJ Roger. And yeah, so that's everything right now.
If you enjoy my books, I get a lot of questions all the time about, hey, you know, Jeff, what books do you enjoy? And we're going to do an episode probably on that at some point, you know, books that just I enjoy and I recommend. But, you know, make sure you check out that book. And it's really, again, an intelligent way of thinking. I look at the mob a different way. And I'm going to put links to the book and to RJ's YouTube channel in the description of this and wherever you're listening, whether it's Spotify, Google Pods, iTunes, whatever. RJ, hope to talk to you again, and I'm sure we will. You're a great guy. You know a ton. And I'm really happy that we were able to have you on. Thanks for coming on the sit down, brother.
Jeff, I appreciate you inviting me. Like I always tell you, I look at you as my friend, my brother, and I'm colleague in this genre, and I'm always grateful for you, man.
Thank you, and you surely are. As always, appreciate you all listening to the show. Next week, we'll have another great episode planned. Have a great Thanksgiving. Enjoy time with your family. And as always, if you enjoy our show, make sure you tell somebody that you think might enjoy it. Also, give us a deserved rating on iTunes or wherever you're listening, and leave us a review as well. We always appreciate your kind words. I am Jeff Nadeau. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.